I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Many parents worry that their kids are spending too much time staring at screens, posting on social media, playing video games, watching YouTube, and they get angry when told to put their smartphones away or seem lost without their devices. Is this the sign of an addiction? The research is not all that helpful. For one, screen time can mean many different things. It can be a great escape. It can be a great connector. It can also be a source of family friction about when and where screens are okay and when they're not. The World Health Organization released new guidelines saying no screen time for babies and limited screen time for toddlers, about an hour a day. But what about tweens and teens? What's the right amount of screen time for older kids? In this hour of Radio Times, we want to take a look at what we know and don't know about the effects of screen time on kids' mental, physical, social, and emotional health. And we'll discuss how parents can help their kids manage their usage. We have two guests who have joined us on Radio Times, and both of them have studied the effects of digital technology on children and children's development. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's the Stanley and Deborah Lefkowitz Faculty Fellow in the Department of Psychology at Temple University, also a senior fellow at Brookings Institution. And Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by telephone is Dimitri Christakis, and he's director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior, and Development at Seattle Children's Research Institute. He's a pediatrician at Seattle's Children's Hospital and a professor in the School of Medicine at the University of Washington and editor-in-chief of JAMA Pediatrics. Dimitri Christakis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me say, I am talking to the two of you with two screens about a foot and a half from my face. There's a TV set that's on, over, turned down there. At my desk is another screen. In my purse is another screen. In my book bag is another screen. I have screens at home. Kathy, this is the world we all live in. Yes? And
yes.
It's not going away.
No, it's not going away. The real question here is, how can we achieve balance with it? Because if you think about it, this is a great natural experiment that we're performing on all of us. You know, the smartphone has only been here since 2007. Right. That means that you're only looking at a 12-year-old, right?
And acting like a 12-year-old.
And acting like a 12-year-old. And tablets have only been around since 2010. So that means they're still in, like, elementary school. So there's a lot we don't know yet about what this exposure means.
Well, let me go back to you, or go to you, Dimitri, and how do you see the lure of these devices? And I'm thinking there was a time when there was a lot of concern about TV watching, I think not illegitimate, but at the same time with a smartphone, it's with you all the time. Does that change the conversation?
Yeah, I think the landscape changed really dramatically with the introduction of let's not talk about smartphones or tablets. Let's talk about sort of touch screens, because that's kind of what they really are and how they function. And that, for 50 years, we had television, and afterwards we had computers, but that was really a very passive experience. The act really was one of sitting and watching. And with the advent of these touch screens, we could have kind of what's called contingent responses. So the screen does something according to what you do. It's reactive that way. And that really was a game changer. And I think, as Kathy said, in really positive and negative ways, and in ways that we're still trying to understand. But that allure, that draw that you're alluding to, is really based on that change in the nature of the relationships we have with screens.
And Dimitri, I mean, that's what keeps us connected, right? That the fact that there is this kind of interaction that is happening.
Exactly. And I think that people need to be very cognizant of the fact that draw of the screen is not accidental, it's not incidental, it's not coincidental. It's quite intentional. The purveyors of both the apps and the platforms themselves are really building in features that make it difficult to disengage. We live in what many people call an attentional economy, and our time on a device or on a platform or an app is monetized. It's part of the business model, and so they're designed to make it hard for us to get away from.
Are we rats in a maze?
Well, it's funny you say that because, in fact, in many ways, a lot of these platforms are conducting experiments on us all the time. Facebook does hundreds of thousands of A versus B experiments on us. So unbeknownst to us, some of us are seeing one kind of a screen, and some of us are seeing another kind of a screen. Mm. Some people's likes are being prioritized, others are not. And they're collecting that data on a continuous basis and making changes to how we see things.
Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what you said, Dimitri. And hi, it's so good to talk to you.
You two know each other, I should say. Yeah,
to be on the phone with you. Yeah.
but I just want to say that it is kind of addicting. And Dimitri's so right. I mean, the companies know it. These are designed to be digital candy. And where I think some of the worry is that while they are interactive, they're not adaptive in the same way that social interaction is. And so while we are being groomed to look at these devices all the time because they're really cool and we want to be on them, sometimes we're plugged in and tuned out. And when we're tuned out to social skills, we don't learn those skills as well. And that can have consequences.
Kathy, give us some facts and figures about children and also teenagers and just their screen use, if we can put it that way.
Yeah, let's just start with some of the numbers. And, you know, we can't even keep up with the numbers. So let me start there. Like, everything you have is old by the day you try to report it. Okay. So the first thing was interesting, and I learned it on the 2020 show myself.
A couple weeks ago,
that the average adult is spending 49 days a year, okay, on their phone, looking at or doing something with their phone. That's, like, pretty incredible.
Yeah.
All right, now let's go to young kids. 97% of 0 to 4-year-olds are using mobile devices, right? 75% have their own tablet.
0 to 4 have their own tablet.
That was 0 to 4.
Okay.
Yeah. 90% started using some of these devices before they were 1 year of age. 73% of kids and parents are using these devices during family meals. 20% fewer conversations are happening at dinner tables because these devices are out. And 30% of parents are even distracted when they're at the playground. They're not really, you know, interacting or looking at kids anymore because their eyes are down. Let's go to teens for just a moment. This is August 2018, so it's like really, really old. This is, you know, prehistoric age. The average was 9 hours a day online for the teens. It was about 6 hours for those age 8 to 12 and 50 minutes a day for the 0 to 8 crowd.
That's a lot of time online. Dimitri, is it that if there is a problem, is it because we are spending so much time on these devices? And I'm saying we because I think we should include all of us into this conversation. Or is it because we're on these devices so much we are not doing other things or even learning some of these social skills that Kathy was talking about?
Yeah, it's a really important point. You know, I think when I kind of conceptualize the effects that digital media have on all of us, because you're absolutely right, it's infants to adults, I think of it through two pathways. And one is what I call the direct pathway, which is to say, how does what you're watching directly impact your behavior, your cognition, your social function, right? So, for example, we know that watching violence on screen increases real-world aggression. That's a direct effect. And the second effect is, I might also point out, so they don't only emphasize the negative, we also know that watching pro-social educational programs, well-designed ones for young children, can improve pro-social skills and literacy and et cetera. The indirect pathway is fundamentally mediated through displacement, which is to say, what are you not doing? What skills are you not acquiring? What interactions are not happening because you're on this device? So that pathway becomes important, as Kathy said, when we see that X percent of people are on their screens during dinner. Right. We know exactly what's not happening when they're on that device at dinner. They're not having real-world conversations with their parents. They're not debriefing about how school was. All of those things have been shown through decades of research to be incredibly important to children's social and cognitive functioning. So even if a child is using high-quality digital media, It also matters when they're doing it, because that can mean they're not getting other important experiences.
Can I just throw out something thinking about if people are not on their devices at dinner, that they are having meaningful conversations? I don't think that's always the case. And sometimes they're having arguments. I mean, I don't want to...
Well, learning how to argue is not a bad thing
not
either.
Not a bad thing at all. But I know you want to add something, Kathy.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I wanted to add that there's one more indirect pathway, Dimitri, that I would add. And that's us. All right, when parents are on their devices.
Absolutely.
And when the kids really might want our attention, but we're so busy doing something else. So I'll just give you two examples of that. One is a beautiful study that was done by Tracy Dennis Tiwari. And what she had is sometimes called the still face design in our research. All right, so there you are playing with your child, and all of a sudden you're instructed to just look at your cell phone. You know, some text just came in. Only stare at that for a while. So we have the parents break the action. They look at the cell phone. What happens to the child? One three-year-old who was in our lab and captured again on the 2020 segment looked at the mom. The mom wasn't engaging. Looked at the mom. The mom wasn't engaging. Hightailed it for the door. Looked back at the mom and said, well, you're not paying attention to me.
Hmm.
And in another study that we carried out in our lab, we had the mom just, you know, using some new words with a young child. And in one case, the mom was interrupted by a cell phone call. And in the other, the mom wasn't interrupted. Everything else was the same. Time on the word, everything. All right. When did the child learn the word? Only in the uninterrupted condition, not in the interrupted condition. So it's as if when you pick out that device, you're saying, this is not for you anymore, kid. I'm somewhere else. What are we as adults teaching the kids?
What are we as adults, Dimitri, teaching the kids? And we're about a minute before our first break here. And I do want to focus in on teenagers and tweenagers as well, because I think there's an interesting conversation to be had there. But what are we teaching them, Dimitri?
Well, I think it's, you know, the phenomenon that Kathy identified is a real one, and some people call it technoference. Because it does disrupt these important interactions that parents have with their children. But the other thing that you're teaching them, and I think this is a really important point that you alluded to earlier, is you're modeling behaviors. And young children start to mimic their parents really from infancy. In fact, it's funny because one of the most prized possessions, one of the most prized toys, if you will, for very young children, infants and preschoolers, is a mock cell phone. Why? Because they've seen it as being something that's incredibly important in the family, a valued thing that everybody has and spends time with. And so there's a very powerful message that's being sent, and I think that's incredibly important for parents to keep in mind, that they need to model the kinds of behaviors with these devices they want their children to adapt.
Well, we are talking about screen time and children with Dimitri Christakis and Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Excuse me, and we're talking about what we know about the effects of screens on children's mental, physical, and social health. How do we differentiate good screen time from bad screen time? And finally, what's the best way to manage screen time for children, or to get children to manage it for themselves? And again, our guests are Kathy Hirsch-Pasek. She's the Stanley and Deborah Lefkowitz Faculty Fellow in the Department of Psychology at Temple University, also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And joining us by telephone, Dimitri Christakis, and he's director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior, and Development at Seattle Children's Research Institute. Dimitri, let me go back to you and just ask you, because to be perfectly honest, one of the reasons we wanted to do the show was to talk about teenagers or young teenagers and the fact that they're different from four-year-olds and that parents have less control over their lives. Most of them, I think something like 95% of teenagers, have a smartphone. So we're talking about the fact that they've got this device in their pocket with them all the time. And I think for parents who are not necessarily on screens all the time, want to figure out how do we get this child to manage their own screen time without a lot of screaming and yelling? Your thoughts?
It's a really good question. And in fact, you know, I was one of the authors of the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for parents, which stated and still state that that kids, teenagers should have no more than 2 hours of recreational screen time a day. That recommendation is, frankly, fundamentally impractical for parents to right. to police. Sure. There's no way for them to know how much time their child is spending recreationally when, as you said, they basically carry a computer in their pocket. I'm always reluctant to call it a phone because it's the one thing that teenagers never do is talk on it. But nevertheless, it's something that they have access to without much supervision from their parents. So I recommend kind of the opposite approach now because it's too difficult for parents to know how much time their child is on a screen. They should focus on how much time they're off a screen. And my recommendation is that they make sure that their child is unplugged for at least 3 hours a day. And those 3 hours should come or could come at dinner, which should really be a screen-free time, an hour before bedtime, because we know that screen use before bed inhibits sleep. In fact, even the presence of a phone in the room at bedtime inhibits sleep induction. We can talk about that if you want. And then one other additional hour, which could be an after-school activity, a sport, et cetera. And I think that's the minimum amount of time that children should be off-screen. Now, the other thing I should point out is that when children get a device, which is typically around middle school, although it's getting younger in certain demographics, parents should establish what I call a cell phone contract or a digital device contract. There are many of these available online if parents Google it. The American Academy of Pediatrics has one. Common Sense Media has one. Many people have just put up their own. And I would encourage parents to basically tailor it to their own situation. But it starts with a very, very specific premise, which is that the possession of a smartphone is a privilege and not a right, and that the phone belongs to the parents. And these are the conditions under which the child can have it, and these are the expectations with which it comes, and these are the sanctions for violation of these rules. And I'm sketching it out in broad brush strokes here, because I think each family has to come up with their own kind of specifications and penalties. But that's the basic framework. And I think that should be a contract that's articulated up front, and most importantly, that's enforced. That's sort of my general. And then the other thing is that there are tools now that weren't available even 3 or 4 years ago. Apple now has a screen time device that's built in. It's not as ideal as it could be, but it's the first generation, and I'm sure it'll be improved. There are other third-party apps which are now, unfortunately, at least in the case of Apple, being blocked, but they certainly work on Android devices. And I think it's really good for parents to sensitize teens about how much time they're spending on their phones, where they're spending it, et cetera. And I want to return to what I said before about modeling, because I think one of the best ways for parents to do that is to be a good role model and to check their own screen use and share it with their children and share how they're spending their time and how much time they may be spending and how do they differentiate between what would be productive screen time that's work-related and kind of recreational screen time.
Kathy, let me go back to you. And I'm thinking of a, let's say, 13 or 14-year-old. How do you sell to them you're not being punished? You're not by limiting your screen time. It's not a punishment, even though it may feel like one to them, or it's denying them something that they really want. And this gets into this question about whether the child is addicted or overusing it or finding an escape that prevents them from interacting with the rest of the world.
Yeah, my sense is that we shouldn't start with a punitive attitude. I completely agree with Dimitri, the contract. And to me, the contract implies a conversation. It's a conversation about how we use it and a conversation about how they can use phones responsibly. So I kind of think of it like nutrition. All right. So I don't know of any kids who wouldn't rather have chocolate cake for dinner. Like, I know I would have been
three courses
of it. Okay.
Right?
And the last thing that I really wanted was veggies. But my mom never let me just have chocolate cake. it's what I wanted. I would have spent every meal on my chocolate cake. But we had a discussion about the different food groups. What were power foods? What was going to help me grow? Why I needed protein? And then I was going to get my chocolate cake for dessert if I ate my power foods first. So I think if we talk about our kids like they are responsible human beings and say, let's negotiate where we're at here. How much time? What times? I think Dimitri brought up this whole issue of before bed. Terrible.
Because
teens already
right?
have sleep issues. And it turns out the luminescence of the screen is really, really bad for sleep. How much time you should be on? What are you watching? What's responsible to watch and what isn't? Again, not all screen time is created equal. On the one hand, it offers connectivity we've never had before, and Google Maps can take us anywhere in the world, even if we don't have the money to buy the ticket. So it has tremendous advantages, but it also takes us away from a lot of stuff. So how do you balance that? And of course, that balance is going to be different for different kids and certainly for kids of different ages.
It seems to me that teenagers don't like the idea, broadly speaking, don't like the idea that someone is manipulating them or, you know, that somehow someone's trying to get something over on them. And I wonder whether even just reframing it to say, this is how these companies are keeping you plugged in. And,
yeah.
and by
yeah.
beeping at
letting
you
them
and
know.
Making noises so that you will be constantly online, whether that's helpful to a teenager.
Well, I just think they need to know the full breadth of what we have here and what's healthy and what isn't. And on the question you asked really before that, there is a ton of work on parenting out there. And you know what? The laissez-faire method just isn't the best method. Hmm. Most of what we found in the literature is that children do want boundaries, and they want us to set those boundaries. And if we don't, believe it or not, we're doing a disservice not only to the health and well-being of our family and our home life, but also to our children.
You know, Dimitri, I'm looking at something. This is from the Pew Internet study of teenagers and technology. Again, 95% of teenagers on smartphones. But interestingly, about 31% said it had a mostly positive effect in that they could connect with family and friends, easier to find news. About 45% thought it was neither positive nor negative. But about 24% thought it was mostly negative, including things like bullying and mm-hmm. spreading rumors and harming relationships. So it seems like teenagers do understand to some degree the effect of this technology on their emotional lives.
They do, and I think the encouraging thing is that we're seeing an uptick in teens recognizing the downside and having greater ambivalence about the value these technologies add. And again, I think that the really critical point here that Kathy made is that there's no way in which getting rid of these things would make the world a better place. More importantly, there's no way in which that's really a realistic option. They're too embedded in the fabric of our society at this stage. So the real challenge is, how do we help teens and help ourselves develop healthy relationships with these devices? And I think technology is helping with that. As I said, I think we're sort of at the tip of the iceberg of the tech industry realizing that they may have gone too far in pushing these on us, and in fact, there may be money in making technology that's more healthy for us to use.
How do we know, though, if it's an addiction? And broadly speaking, an addiction is in many ways a compulsion. It's hard to withdraw. You know it's harmful, but you still do it. And there's some degree of tolerance. Dimitri, I'm back at you. Does that apply an addiction to some of these devices or to screen time?
Yeah. So first of all, we want to distinguish between compulsion and addiction. Compulsion is sort of in the pathway leading to addiction. When we think about addiction, it really means that it's interfering with your activities of daily living, that you're not able to function because of your need to interact with the device. And in the case of smartphones or digital addiction, as I like to call it, the parallel would be to gambling. Because that's really a behavioral addiction as opposed to a pharmacological addiction like alcohol or drugs. The DSM-5 considered gaming disorder as an addiction and ultimately decided that it needed further study. The WHO did, in fact, called Gaming Disorder a Real Thing. If you look internationally, the prevalence of gaming disorder addiction, which I think is a misnomer because there's a lot more to addiction on these devices than just playing games. As you know, people can be addicted to Instagram or other apps or even just to their phone itself. But if you look at the overall prevalence, it's, internationally, it's between about 5 and 12% of adults and older and adolescents are showing signs of what we would call actual addiction. But that, I think, underestimates the real scope of the problem, because short of that addiction, there are a lot of people that are compulsively using their phone in ways that we're still trying to understand what the implications of are. So I spend a lot of time in airports, more time than I wish I did. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me is if you just glance around an airport, you'll notice that everybody is on their phone. They're on their phone when they're waiting in line at Starbucks. They're on their phone at their gate. They're on the phone walking down the corridors of the airport. And think about that. Think if you can, visually, remember 10 years ago when that was not the case. What was happening? What were all these people doing when they weren't on their phones? They were clearly, on some level, looking around, making eye contact with other people, probably talking to their neighbors, maybe reading a book. There's a lot of activities that are not happening as a result of this technology being part of our lives. And that level of compulsion, that desire, that need to check on your phone instead of looking around you and engaging other people, I think represents, in some ways, a more subtle but more pervasive threat than actual addiction.
Kathy, let me get you back in on the conversation. And, you know, we're focusing on teenagers, but also young children as well. And I'm wondering about things like even brain development. Do we know enough to know what this interaction might be about?
Yeah, we seriously don't. The research
isn't. It's new technology,
it's
right?
New technology. And I just want to say, you know, there's even a name for why we check so compulsively. They call it fear of missing out. Right. So a lot of people have talked about that. But I did want to raise in middle school, there is a relatively recent, I think it was last year, principal's report that came out. What are the five things you're most worried about? And what never appeared in the top five and all of a sudden did last year was emotional stability. Uh-huh. And a lot of people are questioning. There's no causal link here that we know about, but they're questioning whether some of this might come from the kind of retreat that we have when we're all on phones sitting right next to each other but not really even sharing a glance, as Dimitri talked about in those airports. Now, what we do know about in brain development, at least for young kids, is that this back and forth contingent human social responsiveness is critically important to how we build things like language skills, to how we build things that are going to be attention and memory, flexibility. Collectively, we call those executive function skills. And those two pieces have tremendous predictability to what you're going to look like in your academic and social success, not only in early school, but all the way out through high school. So it's something I think we want to keep our eye on. And the principals are starting to see it early. Psychologists and psychiatrists are reporting issues right now that we haven't seen before. And, you know, again, it's a great natural experiment that's only been with us for 12 years.
Dimitri, let me ask you very practically. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I want to say also that this issue of compulsive use, because addiction would be misplaced in this context, really does start in preschool children.
Yes. Yes.
And we focus so much on older children and adults around this problematic use, but we see it in young infants. In my lab, we bring children in, and we find that they find it much more difficult to disengage from touch screens than they do from traditional toys, even electronic toys. And there are several reasons for it that are kind of built in. I mentioned before, we've talked a lot about this issue of contingent responses. Babies are born really with an incredibly strong drive to understand causality, right? They don't know the rules of the world they're inhabiting, and they're focused intensely on trying to figure out what makes something happen. And so the feedback they get from a touchscreen the reinforcing behavior when they touch it and it does something predictable is incredibly gratifying to them, draws them to it. And the other kind of reflex that children, infants have is this what's called a violation of the expectations paradigm, which is to say that if something unexpected happens, something that they did not predict would happen, it's also very alluring because it doesn't make sense to them and they want to focus on it and try to figure out why a rule is being violated. And a lot of these apps do just that for infants. They're unpredictable in what they in the feedback they give. And so what we find is that even very, very young children and infants find it very, very alluring to be with these devices. And in fact, we did research about 8 years ago where we looked to see how much time children spend during the day with various toys. And the typical child, typical 18 to 24-month-old child, will spend on average 20 minutes a day with their favorite toy, whether it's blocks or a doll or a truck. That's how much time they'll spend. They will spend considerably more time with the touchscreen device, with an iPad, very, very easily. So that alone tells you something, right? I mean, on the one hand, it tells you that this device is very engaging.
Exactly.
Maybe there's some upside to
that. My thoughts exactly, yes.
But on the other hand, it tells you that it's fundamentally different than any other toy, even their favorite toy, and to the point where they will play with it obsessively. And we need to be cautious of that.
I know you want to add something. We're almost up in a break here. Kathy Hirschbasic, so hold on to that thought. We will take that short break and then get back to our conversation. We're talking about touch screens and children's development. And that's Dimitri Christakis. And he's director of the Center for Child Health Behavior and Development at Seattle Children's Research Institute. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Kathy Hirschbasic. She's a faculty fellow in the Department of Psychology at Temple University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and both of our guests have studied the effects of digital technology on children, on play and learning. And again, we have some open lines, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guests about how much screen time is too much screen time when it comes to children, whether young children or certainly teenagers as well. And Kathy, you wanted to add something to what Dimitri was saying right before the break.
Right. Well, the first thing I wanted to add is I think Dimitri is dead on when it comes to why are these things so cool? I mean, why are they so attractive? Well, I mean, being unexpected is part of it. The others, they're bright. Right. And they make
literally
noises like they're really something. And they're like digital candy. Like, who wouldn't want to go for the candy? So we actually did some studies in our lab that show very much the same thing Dimitri showed. Let's take a shape sorter. OK, you can have a digital shape sorter these days and you buy the digital piece and you plop it in the triangle and it goes triangle. Triangle. Okay, so it's not, you know, like as soothing as maybe a mother would be, but it does spit out the name of the shape. So the kids spent a long time on this. So what happens when the kid's playing with e-toys? The parents retreated into the background, and while they got more spitting out of the names of the stuff, the kids actually didn't learn the shapes as well. Isn't that interesting?
That's fascinating.
Second thing is we looked at e-books versus traditional books. Now, what kids love to do with the e-books is press the buttons. Okay, so one of my students called it induced ADHD. And when you look at both the emotional bonding, and we can actually do like look at your skin and heart responses and stuff like that, and you look at what the kids get out of the book, especially for younger kids, they're addicted to the e-book, but they don't get as much out of it. Hmm. And finally, there are screens everywhere. And you know that you can watch your kids. They'll gravitate to looking at the screen wherever it is. I think it's a new condition I'm calling secondhand screens.
And we've got a bunch of them in this room, even as we speak.
Let me
read some comments. One from Danny. He says, I have a 13-year-old daughter. All she does is get on her phone after school. How can I want her to want to do other things like go outside? Dimitri, do you have advice for Danny?
Well, I do. I think that, you know, I appreciate his concern, and he's not alone. This is a common problem that he's facing. You know, it's every child is unique, and it's hard to give advice without having more details about what will work for her. But I think he recognizes a problem that's an important one, and I think he needs to have an exploration with her about what alternative activities might be enticing. And I think it's really good to find ones that naturally make children be off screens. You see, one of the challenges is, as you said before, taking away the device creates conflict. Putting a child in a situation where device-free time is built in works much better. So if you're outdoors, out of cell phone range, there isn't.
Where is that, by the way?
Well,
in Philly, it's in Gladwin.
In Philadelphia, it might be a challenge, but in Seattle, if you get just an hour out of the city, you can be in the mountains.
All right.
But activities that make it impossible to have a cell phone, whether it's, let's say, being on a climbing wall, so you can't have your phone up there with you because your hands are occupied, or being in a sport or a club where the rule is that there's no smartphone usage, so that it's not him who's taking away the phone, it's the activity or the structure of that activity that makes them be offline for a while.
And how about parents? I mean, we've been talking a lot about parents, in a sense, offering a way to behave. If parents are not outside, you know, why would their kids want to be outside? I mean, I realize when they get older, they don't necessarily want to be with their parents. But nonetheless,
right.
I'm looking at you, Kathy, how we model our own behavior.
I was going to say, it's about modeling, and it's about we have to take digital recess, if you like, and navigate it ourselves. And we're not so good at that. You know, a lot of times we're sitting there looking at screens and not at our children. And I remember once my middle schooler said to me, "Mom, I need your eyes over here.
Oh, interesting.
Look at me."
We've all been there. Just so you know, you're not alone, Kathy. Yeah, go ahead, Dimitri, and then I'll read some more comments
here. There was a fascinating experiment, not from my lab, from a group in L.A., in middle school kids, and they were randomized to go to a nature camp for a week, which was required them to be unplugged because, again, there was no access to internet there, so they left their phones at home. Or in the control group, they did kind of business as usual, which is spend most of your time on a phone. And they assessed what's called social cognition, which is to say how well children can read faces. You show them a face and you ask them what emotion is being displayed. And they did that before and after in both groups. And what they found was that a week at the nature camp, those kids performed much better on recognizing facial emotions. Mm. Why? Well, it could be many reasons. But one of them is, as we've been talking about, that they spent that week looking at other people's faces and learning how to react to them. Now, that to me was really a study that should give all of us a lot of pause. Because even with 1 week of being unplugged, you can notice differences in how children react to other people, how well they're able to read other people's emotions. So imagine what the consequences are of not having that as part of your daily life, as part of the norm, which is the case for most middle school kids. We're really missing out on an opportunity. I think it's vitally important that kids are unplugged on a regular basis, so that a digital recess, as one of you said, so they develop those capacities.
Let me read some comments here. One from Nell, speaking to exactly what we were just talking about. She says, "I recently discovered that my 12-year-old son set limits on his own daily screen time on his phone. I think he saw or heard that too much screen time was harmful, and I was pleasantly surprised, to say the least." A tweet from Erica: "Yesterday, I challenged my 7 and 9-year-olds to a screen-free summer after seeing how much screen time they wanted this holiday weekend." I guess that's over the Memorial Day weekend. Let me get Marlene from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And you are on Radio Times, waiting for that red to come up. There we go. Hi, Marlene. Nice to have you with us on
the
show. Hi there.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure.
And thank you to all of your guests. I have an almost 15-month-old, and while we do not let her watch any videos or use any screen time for any recreational purposes, we do use the iPad to communicate with family, like with FaceTiming. And we do that fairly regularly. Is there a difference between screen time that's used, you know, for video games and music versus to communicate with family and you know, for young children such as toddlers?
Marlene,
is it all the same?
It's a great question, and I have to say, both Kathy and I are grandmoms, and we FaceTime with our grandchildren. So just so you know,
all the time.
And Kathy does it every day?
Every day, and I'm happy to report that I did a study on. You see, you get motivation in a lot of different ways, right? Right. And I wanted to know if having FaceTime or video chat was more like television or if it was more like live. And I can now report to you a published study that says it's more like live.
Oh, interesting.
Why? Because we are socially responsive to the child on the other side.
Maybe overly so.
Maybe
right?
overly so. Right? I mean, last night I was watching baby Julian, who's 22 months. He was eating his chicken. He was kind enough to even believe that I could share his chicken right. if he just took his chicken and put it up toward the screen.
Of course.
So actually, you'll notice that in a lot of the recommendations that people are making, we've kind of left FaceTime out of the discussion because it really is a different case.
Oh, that's interesting. Does that surprise you, Dimitri?
No, I agree. I mean, you know, the research on this particular type of use is really in its infancy, and it's difficult to actually isolate out in naturalistic experiments. Why? Because most kids, your child's an exception, but most kids aren't only using FaceTime. They're using all kinds of screens. But I agree with Kathy. There's no theoretical reason to believe that FaceTime would be bad. We know that very young children, younger than 15 months, don't get it. They don't really react to it in any real way. But I don't think it's harmful at all. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not overstimulating, which is the work that we've done with infants, which essentially shows that surreal pacing of programming can be damaging to children's cognition. FaceTime, by definition, happens in real time, and the responses that one gets would be socially appropriate, as Kathy said, the kinds of things that you would do in person if you were there. So I don't think it's bad at all. I don't discourage it in any way.
Kathy, you want to add something?
I would just add that the other plus of FaceTime that I've noticed, this is anecdotal, not my research, is that they know us. And so when you do get together with a child who, God, you want to hug every day but isn't in the same locale, mm-hmm. You get that hug on immediate reunion, and that's a big deal.
Is it also that?
I want to say one other thing about FaceTime, though, because outside of infancy, one of the fascinating things I alluded to before is that kids don't talk on the phone, and that's true,
right.
or that's been true.
Right.
But they are starting to FaceTime, and I think it's fascinating. I think we should encourage it. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, the Jetsons had these phones that you could see people you were talking to, and we've been waiting for them to come for 50 years, and they're here. And I think it's really great that I think it's great that kids talk on the phone instead of texting, which had been the norm.
Mm.
And I think the added value of seeing the person you're talking to, getting that kind of social nuance that only comes from seeing someone's face, is good. And so I would honestly encourage teenagers to use FaceTime in lieu of texting. And in fact, it's funny because therein is another thing, right? Many people count texting as screen time. And it's weird because on the one hand, of course it is. On the other hand, what texting really has displaced has been phone time. Most of us grew up in a situation where as teenagers we would spend hours on the phone, and now teens spend hours texting. I think texting, I think a lot is lost in texting that's present in telephone conversation. But I think more is present in FaceTime than is in regular telephone talking. So I think FaceTime is a good thing.
Well, it's kind of like watching TV with your kids, right? I mean, you're doing it together, which makes it a different interaction.
But the timing is right. And that's the kind of thing that we've looked at, you know, empirically with the brain studies, mm-hmm. is that in meaning, in emotional bonding, in timing, when you have that back and forth and it's timed perfectly, then kids get a lot more out of it and hearing a voice and seeing a face. Notice, too, that in texting, we only send short texts, so they're not nuanced at all. And I think when we move beyond that to have conversations, we get much more out of the interaction.
Emojis don't count?
No, they do not.
Let me get Athena from Newark, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Athena. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I think there's some good points made, but I also think this conversation's a little bit out of touch for modern families. I mean, the reality is that kids are expected to use this technology every day to communicate with their teachers, and submit their homework. And it's not just during school time. It's after school. It's every day. And if we don't have it, they can't submit their homework.
Absolutely. And Athena, no one here is saying we should take away these tools or this technology. I think the question is, if a child is on a screen device 10, 12 hours a day, there is a question about what they're not doing and trying to figure out what that balance is. Does that make sense to you, Athena?
Sure. I mean, I think limitation is important also. And I think the live point for me is, just as a parent, you know, if I don't want my kids to be on the phone or on their technology, you know, I communicate that to them, right, and then they're not on it. So I can't make a contract with a 7-year-old who has a cell phone and expect them to sort of abide by that when they're 15, for example.
Fair enough. I mean, I think Athena actually raises
set the limitation.
Yeah, Athena raises a good point, Dimitri, which is you monitor this like anything else in the family. And does it really need a contract, or does it just need a better conversation?
Well, I'm all for a conversation because I think that's the way we grow responsible kids who teach us and we help teach them what is healthy to eat and what isn't healthy to eat. You know, I really do see those parallels. I think you're actually doing a great job. And mind you, again, what they see, you know, it's not just screen time. It's what you're using it for. It's how much time you're on it. And age absolutely makes a difference. So things have to change over time.
Anything you want to add to that, Dimitri?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think every child is different, and it's entirely possible that a contract doesn't work for every kid. I think on balance, it's a good thing. The larger question, though, which is larger than we have time to cover here, is this issue of technologies in classrooms and technologies in schools, right, in general. And I think there's been a longstanding assumption on many people's part, certainly on most school districts, that technology in the classroom is a good thing. And I'll just throw out a couple of numbers to make the counterfactual point to that. If you look ecologically, in the 80s, there were about 30 students per computer in U.S. schools. And today, on average, it's 3. Many schools, it's 1 laptop per child, as you're well aware.
Sure.
And in those 30 years, the U.S. has moved not one iota on the global stage in terms of where we rank in terms of our educational outcomes. So even though those data are ecological, it's pretty clear that computers in the classroom in and of themselves are not the solution to our educational problems. And I think there needs to be a much more nuanced and rigorous evaluation, not of whether or not tech should be in the classroom, it clearly should be, but how to introduce it in a way that enhances learning without some of the downside risks of it.
Kathy, we're almost out of time here. That puts us back into the teacher, I mean the human that's part of this conversation.
Yeah, and there's some really interesting work out there. I mean, even looking at MOOCs, you know, which are these massive online classes, and do they work? Do they keep kids engaged? And it turns out real-life teachers still win at the end of the day. So humans really need humans, I guess, is the bottom line. And you know, we just need more balance. These are here to stay. They're wonderful. They connect us. And yes, I'm all for modern family. I'm a modern family too. But I like to go outside every so often. And you know what? It's healthy to do so.
Well, we'd like to end on a human note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Kathy Hirsch-Pasek, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, she's a faculty fellow in the Department of Psychology at Temple University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Dimitri Shitakis, thank you for joining us as well.
Pleasure to be here.
And he's director of the Center for Child Health, Behavior and Development at Seattle Children's Research Institute. And we appreciate all those phone calls and all those comments to Radio Times as well. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.